This podcast was recorded and produced in the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. We pay respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. We acknowledge the First Nations people who fought and continue to fight police violence and colonial violence. This podcast is only possible because of the continued resistance and leadership of Aboriginal communities. This episode contains descriptions of racial profiling, police violence, and mentions the use of spit hoods. Please take care while listening.
I think it was targeted, 100%. I reacted. Like, I was like, okay, I'm going back into my organizing mode. And though, even though I, like, don't love doing that because I was so tired, but I was like, I remember my mom was like, are you okay? And I'm, like, pacing back and forth in the corridor. I was like, mom's like, are you okay? And I'm like.
Of your house because the
police. Oh, my house. Yeah, my house, the corridor of my house. And I was like. Like creating WhatsApp groups and like trying to open up communication channels and being like, what can, I don't know what to do because I'm locked up, right? Like, what can I do? The next day, my sister finished with the lollies. A few days later, she's like, oh, I want like this lolly as well. And I want this cake and I want this, you know? And she was also in her period. So she was like, I want this as well. And then the lady just got so fed up with us. And she was just like, you know, you can go and order it yourself. And I was like, no.
We can't. We're not allowed to leave our houses.
This is The People's Record, and my name is Idil Ali. I grew up in the Carlton Flats in Nam, Australia. This series has been exploring the realities of race, policing, and public housing. This time, we look at what happened when the government decided that the whole community needed to be locked in their homes. The voice you just heard is Reem, who was inside when it happened. Victoria was in a COVID-19 lockdown when the state government announced that 9 public housing towers in North Melbourne and Flemington, home to thousands of migrants, refugees and working class communities, would be placed under immediate hard lockdown. No one was allowed out, and only residents that lived there were allowed in. Residents were not consulted. Many found out on the news, more found out through the arrival of more than 500 police officers.
Yeah, with hard lockdown. Like, that was quite, like, we were, like, in under siege. My dad, so funny, Larry Hummel, my dad, like, literally cracked me up. They called up like the main tenants of the house and I'm like, oh, dad, they're here to speak to you. Like, it was when we were in hard lockdown and the government was like, you know, we just want to check in. We just want to like see how you're feeling. And my dad's like, yeah, I feel crap.
Yeah.
This is not great. And he's just like, why are you locking us up? Like, I don't feel safe here now that you've like basically said that we're contaminated with like COVID and we're infected with COVID and so forth. Like, I want to be able to breathe fresh air. Like, I don't. Like, I've got an immunocompromised, blah, blah, blah. And he's just, they're like, yeah, no, we understand. And I'm like, he's like, you know what I feel like? I feel like we're with the West Bank and Flemington's Gaza. he was just like, and my father, like, when he was a freedom fighter, fought alongside PLO. Like, he met Yasser Arafat. So, like, my dad knows history, knows politics.
Yeah.
And he's like, this is the same shit you're doing there.
Yeah.
But we're under siege. Why are you waging a war at us? Like, what have we done, you know?
I saw 520 members of the riot team encircle Flemington Flats and shut everyone into a big prison and not let people have food and necessities of life. And then there were different strategies employed in North Melbourne, different strategies employed all around the city,
yeah.
You know, which were different on the carceral spectrum, but Flemington was certainly Gaza, self-described as Gaza.
That was Sharandev Singh, a street-trained paralegal who spent 30 years working alongside communities targeted by police violence. The official justification was COVID transmissions. The buildings were overcrowded, the government said. The virus was spreading. Priya Kunjan is a postdoctoral research fellow at RMIT, where they study housing insecurity.
There's a really great research paper that I read where somebody was talking about the way that the elevators were talked about in the high-rise buildings as always breaking down became a way to talk about the people that were living in the buildings as well. And eventually, you know, the state did away with those buildings. And I think that analysis is so relevant to Melbourne because we have to think about, you know, why are things breaking down in the buildings? Whose job is it to upkeep these buildings? Who is the landlord here?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
No, absolutely. And I think that we saw the same thing happen during COVID-19, like hard lockdown, where the thing that kept on being said over and over again at the very beginning was like, there's overcrowding in the buildings and that's why COVID is spreading, which everybody who lives in the buildings was like, okay, but who's responsible for the overcrowding in the buildings?
The state, who had underfunded, neglected, and refused to build more public housing, which led to overcrowding, now used the consequences of that neglect as justification for locking people in. To understand why the state felt emboldened to trap thousands of residents inside their homes with a wall of police, you have to look at the solidarity that had been building for years, the kind of solidarity the state fears. It started long before the pandemic. In 2014, Mariki Ernest travelled to North America visiting Indigenous communities there who were blockading police and fighting the state. Mariki is a Kanai and Guntu Jumara activist and one of the founders of WAR, Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance.
They were saying to me, oh, do you want to join our youth movement? I was like, oh yeah, that sounds really cool. I'll join a youth movement. And they hadn't established it. We hadn't established it. They were just talking about it. We wanted to go to Turtle Island. We travelled from one coast to another. And, you know, really inspired by all the different communities that we met over there. We went to blockades. We went and met Native aunties fighting police and the systems. And we heard so many different stories. And I think one of the amazing things about trips like that and meeting Indigenous people from around the world, or not even just Indigenous people, any people who are struggling against colonial forces in their country, you have an opportunity to see yourself through a different lens. You know, it's kind of like a fish doesn't know it's in water. And so, but going to Canada helped me see, I don't know how to explain what I'm going to say, but helped me see my own circumstance from an outside perspective. And I don't know how to explain that. And it was validating. And it kind of dawned on me the expansion of how invasive and how big colonialism is and actually how connected we all are from the expansion of the British Empire. And I think just moments like that. Anyway, long story short, we ended up coming up, it was kind of really radicalizing. And Gord Hill, he's a really well-known historian, Indigenous person over in Turtle Island, and he talked about the Ochre crisis, the Mohawk people and their local community. The Whitefellas over there wanted to build expand a golf course onto their burial ground where their ancestors were buried. And they're like, no. And, you know, it's insane. Like, that's it's so uncivilized to the average person. But that was literally what they were up against. And they are quite, warrior society. They're quite militarized, actually. Mm. They wear military clothing, like the Indigenous people over there. Mm. And, you know, sovereign, no. They said, no, you can't build a golf course on our ancestors' graves. Like, how absurd. Anyway, it come to the point of conflict and a police officer died in the conflict. And they didn't build the golf course. The point of that story that really stuck with me was that community was so small and Canada threw a lot of police resources at attacking this community who blockaded. And the commentary that Gord Hill said around that moment was that changed the relationship between Canada and Indigenous peoples. And that happened in 1995. And I was like, oh, they had nothing. We have nothing. And the power of just Indigenous communities coming together and refusing was really, that spoke to me a lot. And I think that inspired a lot of where WAR came from. We came up with a name over there. We're like, yeah, WAR, Warriors, the Aboriginal Resistance. Yeah, so taking inspiration from a lot of different youth movements around the globe, that's sort of how that came about. And then at the G20 in 2014, we launched Warriors, the Aboriginal Resistance. And I thought we were just going to be five blackfellas just really angry writing and talking about what we want. I genuinely didn't think anyone would give a stuff about what we were saying.
But it didn't stay five people. It grew into a movement that redefined resistance in the city, I'd argue this continent. And for the young African people growing up in the flats, watching that resistance was a call to action. 2 years later, in 2016, horrific footage was released showing the torture of Aboriginal children at Don Dale Youth Detention Centre.
most of us recall the image of Dylan Voller strapped to a mechanical restraint chair with a spit hood over his head. In response, war led protests in Nam. During one protest, activists chained their neck to a metal cage in the street to represent what was happening to incarcerated youth. And standing around that cage, forming a physical barrier between them and the police, were people in solidarity. Among them were young people from the flats.
It's the thing of what you said about, we know in our homes that this is invasion day, and then you go out and it's saying the thing that you say in your home when you're with your community out loud for everybody else to hear. And I think for me, when I went to, I remember the protests around Dawndale, and I remember hearing you guys speak, and that moment, do you know when you're at a protest and somebody speaking and you can feel the rumble in your whole body? Like, do you know when you're like, feel the shiver? It was like that. Like, I'm like, oh, like normally you don't know when your life changed.
Yeah.
Sorry. We're both crying right now. It's like most of the time when your life changes, you can't pinpoint those moments. But I remember being there and feeling like I knew exactly my life changed right now. Like, you know, and I just remember seeing that cage and looking around the people who are surrounding the cage. And I think that there's like there's this idea in protest in the last few years around like marshalling and stuff. And it's like people with privilege at the front and like all this stuff. And it's like white people to the front, like the black people to the back, which is so hilarious when they say it, they can't even hear themselves. But I just like hear that. And I'm like, you don't even know how it started, because I just remember looking around and just African people just being around, and like Pacifica black people just being around that cage whilst mob are chained to the cage and making it so clear that if they move the cage that they would choke people. And I just, there's no you know, that time was a big time for identity politics, but when it comes down to it, when it comes to protecting people and you love, you know, like at the time I didn't know you guys that well, like that's when I started to meet you mob, but the other African people that I did know knew you guys really well. And, you know, in Fitzroy parting with you guys, like, you know, there's like this, it's family, right?
Yeah.
And the people you love, when they love people, you love them too, right? And I just think about that moment of hearing you guys say things exactly as it was.
That was the origin story. The literal physical formation of a unified front to protect each other from police violence. 4 years later, in June 2020, that same solidarity flooded the streets. Tens of thousands of people marched through Nam for Black Lives Matter, led once again by war. Crystal joined Mariki and I to talk about the organising.
So you were part of organising the 2020 Black Lives Matter rally in Nam. Can you take us back to that moment? What was that like? What was the organising for that like?
Chaos?
Chaos, yeah.
From memory, we were working really hard to make sure that the families of people who had died in custody, their voices were really pushed, like to be centered, and their testimony or their statements were being read out. Pretty sure that,
and like we wanted to make sure that all of the different communities that are within Nam and beyond had a voice, because it was really a international movement, not only to speak about the and to kind of raise our voices and our bodies against what was happening in the United States, but it was also about the localized police violence and police harm. And police are central to the Colonial Project wherever they are. You know, that's one of the arms about how they are able to colonize wherever they are. And so in doing our organizing, we were trying to make sure that all of the different communities were able to speak to that violence that they experience. I remember going there when we walked up. Do you remember there wasn't that many people and we were like, oh, maybe no one's going to come?
Oh my God. It was one of the biggest protests we've ever organized.
Yeah.
I think, and then it was a testament to the message and the moment.
Yeah, and the amount of communities that experienced the police violence.
And finally having this moment where we're going to talk about this specifically, And it just felt like this moment, this global moment that we were able to take hold of and put our communities in that, you know, find that common thread of what we're all experiencing in police oppression.
But I think that's all the more reason why we should keep organising and keep building community. And I think the NAM Black Lives Matter protest too is a testament to the work that a lot of people have done to build solidarity between communities over many years. And I think that that strength showed up that day where there's a lot of different communities who, yeah, have been working together for a long time and showing up for each other for a long time. And that's why, you know, we help, you know, a lot of us who've known each other for a while have trust in each other about, you know, organising decisions or speaking or, you know, asking someone to speak and knowing, I guess, that if something happened, then would show up for you as well.
But that kind of unified power, Aboriginal and African people standing together, refusing to be tone policed about state violence, is exactly what the system fears most. So the government and the media moved to punish it. The people protesting police violence were suddenly framed as a public health threat.
At the time of the BLM rally, there wasn't any of, there was not even the mandate to wear masks.
Yeah.
Oh, we weren't allowed it outside at all, hey?
Yeah, it was like you, yeah, there was something, we should have looked this up. Because we've done so many rallies during COVID as well. So I think the 100 people and then the 19 people, they were at Invasion Day and other ones.
Oh, okay.
But the BLM one, it was, there weren't those mandates to wear masks or hand sanitizer at the time. So
yeah,
we were
the first
organising that in that way, you know.
And we were the first public event.
Do you remember that Herald Sun reporter? I was about to swear then. That Herald Sun reporter wasn't wearing a mask.
Yes, the only person at the protest. Oh, my God, we took photos of her. We put it on her social media.
Because she'd interviewed us like the week before, remember?
Oh, and she smashed us.
Yeah.
Like, and so we
and put like a headline, COVID idiots.
COVID idiots. And they put the worst photos of us. And like we really just look like these, you know. Anyway, and I was like, oh, my God, she's the only one not wearing a mask. And so we took a photo of her in the protest. Not, she's the only person not wearing a mask, and we put it online. Anyway, that's a side point.
It's like, but you're dragging us and then you're not even doing it.
The organizers were dragged through the media, targeted, and hit with $1,500 fines.
Then we got charged the $1,500 COVID-19 fine. And I would have paid, I was going to pay it because I was.
Yeah, we were all going to pay it.
I was going to pay it, and then
people started GoFundMes in our name. We're like, take that down.
Like, yeah, I was like, no.
We're not asking for help.
No, we don't need that, you know, because we were like directing all the money to the families.
Yeah, the different family campaigns.
And then we had the amazing Ali Bizaroglu put it in our heads and reminded us that we can fight this and
that there's a greater fight to be had because we can try and hold the police accountable for.
And then, the case was really interesting. So they were, so it was a COVID-19 health, breaching health restrictions at the time. That's the charge that it was. And $1,500. I think it was racially motivated. I think it was to punish us. And I think that the nature of being against black deaths in custody or police killing black communities is fundamentally something that police would love to punish. But it's weird because they backed a losing horse and they knew. So I don't know what they thought they were.
I think the fear. I think the fact that they could build enough fear that you could go to court for it is enough for some other people, not you guys, but for some other people to think twice about organizing protests. I think it's an exercise in fear because, like, when we talk about the settlement and the young people who went through and sued the police for racial profiling, it's like they drag it. One of the mechanisms is to drag it on. One of the mechanisms is to have more resources and for the folk that you've made sure systematically they don't have as many resources to throw those resources at them.
The state wanted to punish a community that had just publicly embarrassed them. 4 weeks later, they found the excuse in locking down the public housing towers. The day they announced the hard lockdown, we did what we always do. We responded.
We were second responders, all the Carlton people that came and like people from neighbouring communities. But the first people to respond were people in the buildings. Like as soon as they heard before, like, people who hadn't gone home yet, they just started buying groceries, started calling everybody, making sure that, like, when they go into their building and they're not allowed to come back out, everybody has, as much as they could, they could bring things, right? And it was the reason why Carlton people, like, we knew what we needed to do next was because people were calling us and saying, hey, like, I'm buying stuff right now. I'm on my way home. But once I go home, I don't think I'm going to be able to get back out. So can you guys, like, get this and that, you know? Hard lockdown started on Saturday. Sunday, we're at AMSA. We're already getting donations. We're already sorting the donations. We're already calling people and finding out what needs to be delivered to every house, you know? But I think what was so surreal for me is they locked people up and they didn't have a plan. It wasn't until days later that they had essential supplies, that they had food packs, that they had.
Five days later.
You know, so I think that.
And that was because, but then the response came from us.
Yeah.
But I also, like, when you were talking, reminded me, like, I think because it's public housing, the government feel like they're entitled to do whatever they want to us.
And when the government's food packs finally did arrive, they revealed exactly what the state thought of us.
Nobody in the buildings wanted their deliveries.
No.
That's my favorite part. Oh, their stuff, they, I remember they came to us. They're giving us,
like, pork and frozen foods. And I literally, well, like, was so pissed off. My brother was pissed off. My brother was like, at that time, 14. He was like, he got Glen 20.
Yeah.
Started spraying at the food. Yeah. He was like, I don't want, my mom's like, we're not getting this. Yeah. 100%.
No, I just remember when they would say to us, like, people are not, they were getting really angry and they were like, people are not taking the food packs inside. They're spoiling outside, da, da, da. And I was like, first of all, they're not even spoiling outside because it's all canned goods. Nobody wants your canned goods. Mm. And they were so confused because they were like, because we live in gov housing, they think we're going to take what they give us. I think about, like, how quickly the community responded to the announcements of the hard lockdown and made sure that community got what they needed. And at the same time, when the state was responding, when, you know, the local councils were responding, how inadequate their response was, and how they had to, like, do better each time because it was in comparison to ours, you know? And I think if there wasn't a comparison, they would have very quietly told us to shut up, you know? And they knew that they couldn't because parents were calling in special orders and people responding were getting, you know, the organic organic formula.
I mean, they weren't even getting halal food.
No.
Like, they didn't even, like,
they didn't even try.
We have been talking about, like, whether they do or don't know and whether this is, like, a weaponized incompetence on the state's part.
And you know our families, we're very fresh food people.
100%.
You know, we're...
My mom was asking for green chilies.
Right?
And she's like, I want injera.
Yeah.
I'm too tired to make my own. I want injera. Yeah. I want green chilies. We eat green chilies with our injera and sepi. Like, this is literally...
Yeah.
Like-
but I remember the thing that really stood out to me was, like, then we started special orders because, you know, there's moms who needed formula for their babies. Babies that had no milk, like, you know. And it's like... and the moms are like to us, we're like, we have formula. What age are they? And they're like, what age is my child? You need to go to the chemist. I only have organic formula. And I said, sorry, Javier, you're absolutely right.
I want the best. What's the best.
I said, how silly am I to think that your child could just have any formula?
Honestly.
What formula do you want me to buy? And I'm writing down the name of the formula. And I'm like, from that point, we were like, okay, we definitely need special orders. But the people who are calling us, they're not saying, I want meat. Or I want beef. Mm. I want, like, they're not saying, they're saying, I want sukkar. I want this type of meat. The small cut. Yeah. And I said, as they should.
100%.
You know, and obviously as us answering the phone calls, but like how embarrassing and shameful to say to them, no, you're just going to have whatever meat we give to you. No.
That's what we say.
Whatever you ask us for, that's what we're going to go get.
While the community sorted food, the media swarmed the towers looking for a spectacle. But the residents didn't wait to be spoken for. They formed their own group to handle the press directly. They called it Voices from the Block. And the same First Nation organisers from WAR stepped right back up to support them.
There was a core group of people who were locked in the towers that were formed a group, and it was called Voices from the Block. I remember, like, WAR did some media training because they were getting harassed with media requests and not wanting, you know, that... you know, weight that anyone who's experienced media attention on an issue that affects a community of people and not wanting to make a mistake, I guess. Yeah, like war has benefited from having media training from really excellent people. And so war, it was April Day, who's the daughter of Tanya Day and the founder of Dajua Foundation. So it was her, Mariki, me, Ricky Onis, me. I can't remember if Tanine was involved, and we held an online meeting and did media training, some like how to pivot and how to continue to get your message across and things like that. And Ruja Meedy was involved as well, and she was in lockdown up in Brisbane actually at the time. So we're doing a lot of meetings online and with not only the people who were locked in the towers but also the community members that were outside.
The solidarity was everywhere. While Crystal helped with the media from the outside, Mariki Ernest was down on the ground with us, packing the food.
I just remember one day we like got a bunch of donations and we sorted through it and then we made all these packs. But by the end of the day, we were all exhausted. And I just remember looking at all the donations and I was like, oh, tomorrow morning we're going to have to get here and like sort them before we start doing packs again. And then as we were leaving, you guys were coming in. I remember seeing you in April and I think maybe was it a Tong as well, like just people who were familiar and they were like walking in and I was like, oh, hey, like, and then you guys were like, oh yeah, go home. Like it's fine. And we get there the next morning and everything's sorted and it's ready to just pack. And I'm just like, oh, it's this stuff. Like this is the stuff that's like,
yeah,
this is the bond. Like this is,
yeah.
It's the relational things that keep our movements going and keep us strong.
And I think that was a strength of the community that was, you know, that happened as well.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, the building on the solidarity that our communities have built over time, we were able to just pull together at that time and say, well, you guys know how to do media and, you know, you've got this connection or this resource somewhere. And I think, you know, that's the importance of also working together and building together. And even in the immediate, even if in the immediate, when you are building solidarity and you don't have an immediate outcome, I think just having relationality and relationship will help us when things happen.
Yeah, and it's a different, it was really humbling and important and learning and also a learning experience organising within a community that's not your own and trying to give the best advice and support, I guess, when we were the ones on the outside.
The community provided for each other, but where were the millions of dollars tied up in local government, health services and NGOs that are meant to support public housing residents?
They all got together and they made the decision and then we were all as volunteers like packing these bags. And for some reason, they made the CEO be like the person to check the bags that we've already packed and sign off on it. And they had this discussion in a meeting, but he was like signing this little piece of paper. So that way when it gets to the building, the police would let it into the building, the donations. Mind you, I'm like, he's not even checking it. He's just like, you just gave this man power over community donated, like all this food, this all came from community. It just made me think about how like wild it is that they put somebody in authority to sign off on something.
It was a harsh reminder of what so many call the not-for-profit industrial complex. The very organizations funded to help were too afraid to bite the hand that feeds them.
I think all community organizations should be doing the advocacy part in order to fully represent and support the communities that they've been built from. I think that people are, or CEOs and boards, different, you know, I think people are hesitant to speak up because they think that, you know, something bad is going to happen or they'll lose funding or lose relationships within the funding bodies and things like that. But actually, I think they should be standing up and fighting, because by being silent, they're removing the reasons why they exist in the first place.
The food response, the special orders, the right formula, the suqar wasn't improvised. It was built on years of knowing who lived in which flat and what they needed. It came from years of being treated as a threat and building infrastructure of care and community against it.
No, it's in the fibre of those places.
Yeah.
It's in the history and the currency of those places to be to be both intensely policed from the outside and to be able to deal with issues of care and harm in those very places, you know. And I think that is one of the reasons why they want to knock those flats down. It's only with the degradation of the physical space do they achieve the degradation and isolation of communities of resistance and colour.
After the lockdown ended, an ombudsman's report found the lockdown had breached people's human rights, but that for the circumstances, it was justified. The same report recommended the government apologise to the community. They never did. Then came the class action against the hard lockdown. There was a settlement. Residents received roughly $1,000 each, an opt-in class action designed to be a bureaucratic nightmare to access. But I often think about what we left with that experience of mutual aid.
People talk about like the state not knowing the relationships, the really deep-seated relationships and attachment that community has to these locations, to these estates, to each other. And I think the state does. And I think that like one of the things that came up was like hard lockdown. And I think about it a lot, and so many of us who responded to it think about it a lot, where we think, did showing our strength benefit us, or did it make us a bigger target? And was the police being deployed there, was it to test our strength in that moment or not? And like, how much were we going to resist? And how quickly was it to like disarm us? Did we show our unity and our strength far too much that's why when the announcements were made, they needed to start with this location?
44 public housing towers to be demolished, starting with North Melbourne and Flemington.
It's not a coincidence.
Yeah.
I think it's not a coincidence. Absolutely. And I think there's something there in regards to how they've like, till this day, like they're just like, oh, they haven't acted the way we wanted them to act.
Mm.
So let's just demolish their homes.
Next time, what it means to be told that the place itself, the basketball courts, the parks, the corridors, the homes, is scheduled for demolition. This is The People's Record, and I'm Idil Ali.
This podcast was produced by Ila Diaz and Lucy Griffin for the Centre Against Racial Profiling. Hosted by Idil Ali, edited and mixed by Andrew Hutan and McEwen. Music by Pip Norman, and designed by Peter Morgan. The People's Records thanks the Community Broadcast Fund, 3CR, and Humdinger Studios for their generous support.